Back in 2012, we released Boomerang for Yahoo Mail, which was our shortest-lived product. It was the only thing I actually killed as CEO, and it lasted 3 months. But the best thing that came out of that is we developed a launch checklist because it was our fourth launch in 3 years, and we had missed stuff and forgotten stuff and overlooked different things each time. And this time we said, we're going to write it down, we're going to get it right, and the next time we need to do this, we're going to have it everything we need in one spot.
So the launch checklist survived the product.
The launch checklist we're still using 13 years later.
Hey there, I'm Alex.
And I'm Mo.
We met at MIT, got married, co-founded Boomerang, invented email snoozing, and have spent a lot of time geeking out about productivity.
On Less Busy Lab, we'll share
and argue about
research-backed tips, productivity hacks, and secrets from 15 years of running a small team that does big things.
There are no silver bullets in productivity, but we'll try to help you get more done while feeling less busy. Let's go!
And this week, we're going to talk about checklists. What's the point of a checklist?
So the checklist is the simplest possible project management tool, aside from just show up and do whatever. And I think because it's so simple, I think it gets, to use a George W. Bushism, misunderestimated in both directions. Like, I think people think, oh, this is too simple to need a checklist. And I think people also think, oh, this is too complicated for a checklist. And they end up going with really much more heavyweight process managers.
So one is too simple. They just say, hey, I'll just do it from memory. This is not big enough of a deal to need a checklist.
Yeah, it's not complicated enough.
Just do it from your memory, and then they miss stuff. And then when it's too complicated, they go overboard and get this workflow tools and $30,000 SaaS product to basically what could be solved with like a couple dozen item checklists.
Exactly. So today we're going to dive into checklists. We're going to talk about a little bit about the history of the checklist. We're going to talk about how we use them internally at Boomerang. And we're going to talk about some of the things we've learned and mistakes we've made about how to make a checklist more usable, get people to comply with it, get people to use it, and just make things better when you're using checklists. So do you want to get us started with the history of checklists?
Yes. The current version of the checklist, the, you know, items with little checkboxes, started back in 1935, and it came with a disaster. The B-17, Boeing's Model 299, colloquially known as Flying Fortress, it crashed when they were testing it out. And it came from a very simple error. The pilot, as they were about to take off, or simply forgot to disengage a locking mechanism. So, you know, the planes, by 1935, things have gotten to get a little bit more complex than what Wright Brothers initially came up with.
So, yeah, this thing had four engines, a bunch of bomb bays. Like, there was a lot to keep track of.
Just being preoccupied and with the excitement of testing a new machine, they forgot a very simple step, which resulted in a crash and killed two of the five people on board.
And that revolutionized everything in avionics, right? Like, airplanes now come with, every airplane has a checklist.
Yeah, so Boeing decided that, hey, instead of trying to just train the pilot more, they realized that at some point things have become complex enough for the pilots to keep everything they need to do in their head. And they wrote down this simple, I think it was like a 19-item checklist.
And one of those things was engage this lock.
Right. Disengage this lock.
Disengage the lock. Okay.
And that kind of got aviation industry on a very good trajectory for safety and efficiency.
And that's their model, right? Like the B-36, a 10-engine bomber, had a six-hour checklist with a follow-up one-hour checklist that had 600 items on it.
I think that might have been the peak of the length of checklist. Now things are starting to get a little bit shorter because a lot of things can be automated.
But it's still, to this day, like when you get on a 737, you know that there's a checklist that the maintenance folks are going to go through one, the pilot's going to go through one, the co-pilot's going to go through one, like everybody's going to do a checklist. And it's not just in aviation now.
Well, when they tried to go to the moon, NASA had multiple checklists before they launched, when they got to the moon, and when they were doing the moonwalk, Armstrong and Aldrin both have a checklist on their cuff of the astronaut suit.
I can imagine needing one. If you're up in the moon and you're like, hey, Mom, I'm on the moon, you're probably going to forget half the stuff you're supposed to do up there.
And there's a very funny story about cuff checklists and Easter eggs that people put in from the ground. When they went for Apollo 12, they basically sneak in Playboy centerfolds into their cuff checklists that the ground crew put in without the knowledge of the astronauts. And when they got to the moon...
A little taste of home.
Yes. These cuff checklists are multi-pages. Each moonwalk has their own list on what they are supposed to do, from collect samples to take a picture of this to take temperature. So they put in these Playboy centerfolds there, and they went out of their way to make this a sneaky surprise for them. And the astronauts, when they saw it, started giggling, but they couldn't say what they were seeing because they were being videotaped, and they didn't want the taxpayers to know how their money is being spent, because these things are not simple to make. They had to print it on fireproof paper.
So can I put some of these in our checklist?
No, you'll get...
Different era.
You'll get canceled.
So then from there, it spread to medicine, right? The concept of a checklist.
Yes. Yeah, so this is, we're talking about 1935, Boeing first disaster, to NASA and the moonwalk 1950s, 60s, 70s. And then fast forward to late 2010s. There is a professor and a doctor named Atul Gawande, and he did a study with the WHO in 8 countries on implementing a surgical checklist. And what he found was the surgeons don't need any more knowledge or training, but they do need a reminder of all the essential things that they need to check before they go into the surgery.
And this all started with sponges, right?
Things people left behind in people's bodies.
So when you're doing surgery, there's a lot of blood, and you need sponges to soak up the blood so you can see what you're doing.
And they
sometimes forget what, you know, don't know how many they got. Oh, I thought there were 7. Okay, I got my 7, but there was 8. And then it's in your body and you get infected.
Well, there's also people getting operated on the wrong leg because they didn't mark the site of the surgery that they were supposed to do.
Yeah, so these aren't things that, like, more training is going to fix. Every surgeon knows. And every surgeon's well-trained. They're smart people, well-trained.
They had hundreds of hours of training, right?
And there's no way that they're going to go in and be like, yeah, I'm going to cut off the wrong leg. Like, nobody would do that.
No. This
But it happens.
And it's more about consistency over time and not more knowledge or expertise. It's more about doing the basic things that you don't feel like should be a big deal that turn out to have a bigger stake, especially surgery where you can kill people. And
I think it's
no
coincidence that these are the folks who would figure out that the checklist is a really good way to go.
So Atul had a hunch that this will save lives. And to really convince the medical community and surgeons especially, because, you know, they're experts. They feel like a simple checklist can't have that big of an impact. So he had to do the studies to prove that how many complication can it reduce. So what they found was this 19-item checklist on a 1.5 pages is saving 36% in complication and almost half of the death.
Like, it cuts the death rate in half?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a big difference.
So 47% drop in surgical death. So WHO officially adopted it as a recommendation in 2008, and Atul wrote all the findings that he got from this study and all his recommendation in a book called Checklist Manifesto in 2009. So it's like late 2009, kind of the era that we were starting Boomerang, right? Like 2010 is when we officially started Boomerang.
Right.
We started reading the Checklist Manifesto at some point and started thinking about how could this help in our knowledge worker world, right? Like, because what we have is not necessarily like life or death situation. I mean, there are life or death software out there.
But our email productivity software generally isn't, I hope.
generally isn't. And we wanted to think through how can it be applicable to our world.
Yeah,
and the other part
regulated.
Is, yeah, it's not regulated.
Lower stakes.
It's not hands-on in the sense of a physical thing, right? Because the checklists after aviation and medicine, they are also very widely used in manufacturing. Is widely used in constructions, right? People have a lot of steps and critical errors that can be made. People are using checklists to prevent all of this. But when you're thinking about our knowledge worker world, what we are doing is launching products and, you know, moving email around is a little bit different.
Yeah, we're not doing this. Also, we're not doing any of these things multiple times a day.
Nope.
We're not doing the same thing multiple times a day.
And there's a lot more coordination, decision, and kind of like context switching that. But in a way, I think it's even more important because things that we do are not so routine, right? Like we don't have a daily things exactly that we do. But we have a lot of things that we do over and over, especially if you're going to be building a long like term surviving company. We do a lot of things maybe every few months. Some of them we do every year. And it will be a waste for us to learn and make the same mistake every time we do them. We only do 3 offsites a year. But after, you know, 10 years of doing them, we know how to run an offsite.
Right. Offsite number 28, we had a lot more idea what we were doing than we did on offsite number 1.
And it's so much more efficient and smooth for everybody who is coming. They have the information they need. They have the supplies, and we've been honing it and operationalizing how to run an offsite.
So I think a couple of my favorite checklists that we use internally at Boomerang, our product launch checklist is the first one we ever came up with. And it's been iterated on for literally 13 years.
Yeah.
And it's got so many sections, so many, if we're doing this, you need these. If you're not doing this, you don't need these. It's probably, what, 2.5 pages long, maybe 3 by now?
Yeah, we had a refactoring recently because things do sometimes tend to pile up as you use it and you keep adding it. And we're trying to kind of figure out how to segment it and make sure that it makes sense. And I think we can talk about it a little bit more from how to make very complex process like a product launch checklist more practical and doesn't get the checklist fatigue. The other one is new hire onboarding, which is, you know, every company has employees starting. And Google actually did a study on new hire onboarding checklists with a new hire getting the checklist the day before versus didn't get a checklist. And they found a 25% higher productivity improvement for the people who got the like simple 5-item checklist. And these are like very simple fundamental stuff like prepare the email assets or how to get a badge.
If you don't have a laptop, it's going to be hard for you to get a whole lot done your first week.
And what they found with that basically is the equivalent of getting like a new employee up to speed 1 month faster.
I think the trend that we're seeing is that everything here is, it's not brain surgery.
It's no.
It's really simple stuff. But the problem is that if you don't have a way to keep track of it, you're relying on working memory.
Yeah, I think what checklists prevent is the failure of execution, right? It's not, we're not talking about failures or ignorance. It's not because people don't know what to do or how to do them.
Or need more training.
Somebody made a mistake because they don't know. That's something that you can remedy with more training and more knowledge.
Yeah.
We're talking about people who are experts or professionals in their field, right? It's not, you don't need a checklist because you're dumb or you don't know enough. You need a checklist because you are an expert and you have so much more cognitive overload than you can handle in just day-to-day operation.
A lot of things are like, they're processes that are complicated enough and have enough steps that they're going to push the limits of your working memory even on a good day.
Right.
And then what happens if, you know, there's research that shows that people can only keep 7 things in their heads at once and working memory. And if 2 of those things are, oh, crap, my kid has a stomach ache, and my boss is kind of mad at me, then you've only got a working memory of 5. So if you've got a 6-step process, you're out of space.
And sometimes it's just like, you might be just simply distracted, right? Like something, you're executing something and somebody walk in the room and ask you a question. You context switch, answer their questions.
Where was I?
Or you just assume because you were doing it and you thought you'd done it and then move to the next steps without having done it. So that's the kind of errors that we prevent. And yes, we are not preventing a plane from exploding, but at the same time, there's a lot of rework and missteps, right? So when we were doing our experiments, so year of experiments at Boomerang was 2024, and we set out
52 A-B tests in a year.
We set out to not just A-B tests, experiments.
Yeah, that's
experiments
true.
Over marketing, product, and the whole funnel through the product. And there were things that we knew we should do them, or we intended to do them, and then we simply forgot. Or sometimes miscommunication and thought, okay, we already put in the analytics, and then you launch the experiment. And then 2 weeks later, you go and look, and there's no data, which means that 2 weeks was a waste of time, right?
Right, yeah. And you were testing this, and you have no idea if it worked.
Right. So there are a lot of things that will save time, efficiency, and coordination.
And if you've got the thing, if you've got the checklist that says, hey, I need to make sure my cohorts are appropriate for logged in or not logged in users, that was a mistake we kept running into. That gives you the freedom of mind to think more deeply about how exactly should I set these cohorts up without having to worry about, am I forgetting to set up cohorts?
Right. And, you know, what resulted was our Trello board that was keeping track of the 52 experiment had 2 different checklists, right? One is pre-flight experiment checklist, and the other one is post-flight. And I think when I think back on it, and the first 12 to 15 experiment, we were just developing the checklist. We kept making different mistakes, and then we keep incorporating into the checklist.
Yeah.
And then it became a steady checklist. And I felt like between the 13 experiment to 40 were a little bit better. And then after a time, we were going on an autopilot. And then the checklist were not adhered to as well as when we first developed it.
And we started missing things again.
Again. And then I think the other part that we should have probably insisted was it should have been a redo. So in Atul Gawande's book, he defined 2 different types of checklists. One is redo, which is you read the steps and actually execute the step before you're moving on to the next one. So a lot of plain and surgical ones are you actually read out loud and do it at the synchronous.
So you have to do step one. So step one is preheat the oven. You have to preheat the oven before you do step 2 of chopping your vegetables.
I don't know that the sequential step is like whether if you switch this flip before the
but
other
you have
flip.
To do, you have to finish the first one.
First
before
one
you
before
start
you
the
start
one.
The second one. And you're doing one at a time.
Yeah.
Versus do confirm is more like the product check launch checklist would be a do confirm, right? Because there are multiple people doing it. And all you need to do is make sure that somebody has done it on the launch day. You're confirming that, oh, we really have updated the pricing grid with a new feature, right?
So it's, hey, find a checkpoint. And at that checkpoint, make sure
all
of
the
things have been checked off.
Exactly.
And it doesn't necessarily matter whether you've done one before you start 2.
Right.
It just matters that at this checkpoint, all 8 of these are done.
Done. Yeah. So it's more of a, do confirms are more of checkpoints with confirming all the necessary steps.
Our business, like running payroll would be very much a redo. Because if you don't change the healthcare contributions before you make the healthcare payment, you've messed it up. So you've really got to do it in the order. One has to be done before you move on to 2, but it just has to be that way. But our new hire onboarding checklist is more of a do confirm.
Yes.
Because it doesn't really matter whether you create their email account before or after you create them in QuickBooks or payroll. Like either way is okay, but you need to make sure that before the end of their first day, you've done all those things.
Yes, and I think product launch checklist is also a do confirm because by nature, you have multiple people that might be doing parallel steps and then you come together at the checkpoint and verify these are done.
Okay, cool. Go ahead. I just wanted to make sure I had a good grip on it.
Yeah, so I forgot where we were.
We need a checklist for this episode. You're saying for our experiments.
Back to the experiments. We have 7 items for pre-flight and like maybe 5 for the post-flight. And those checklists were used more as a do confirm. Okay. And I think it should have been redo, especially the pre-flight.
Okay.
Because if we really block, okay, Mike cannot deploy this experiment unless we have seen evidence of the analytics and data coming in at this step, it would have saved so much pain. We need to have the team approve the cohort definitions, right? Because I think sometimes people will have different definition of cohorts. Our checklist just said, make sure you have cohorts defined. And it doesn't really make it so that everybody's agreeing on these cohorts are the ones that we are thinking. So like experiment designer is thinking one thing. The developer is basically implementing a different thing. And then the product manager is like, oh yeah, we have cohorts. So then what happens is we don't have the cohorts that everybody agree on.
So when we were doing research for this episode, I found this awesome paper from Vanderbilt University where they were talking about applying the lessons of checklists from medicine and aviation to software development.
And I think it was for software safety specifically.
There were 3 major things that went kind of wrong when you were creating a checklist that led to problems like the one that you were talking about. The first one is that you need to make sure every item on your checklist is deterministic and decidable.
Right.
And what that means is that you need to be able to say yes or no, this is done. So that's decidable. So something like, do we have cohorts? I don't know. Do we have cohorts? That may not be the best example.
We says like define cohorts, right? And it's not deterministic.
So deterministic means that 2 people looking at the checklist at this item will always agree that it is done or not done. And
yes.
Then deterministic or decidable means that it is possible to determine whether it is done or not. So if you have something like, make sure there are no bugs, you can't decide that. That's not deterministic. They're not going to agree. There's no way to specifically define that. And I think when we had things like, is analytics hooked up? It's hard to say. But if you go in and say instead, if you go into Google Analytics, do you see a test event in the format for this experiment? And you confirm that that's there, then it becomes confirmed. It becomes something that everyone has to agree on. Is
even
it there,
then,
it
needs
it
to be a little bit more specific. Not just that they are. So right now, I think our current list is like, make sure they are Google Analytics events. It should really be check that you have each cohort analytics events are recorded correctly. And then correctly can be defined.
There you go. It's not deterministic enough.
Exactly. Like, it's so hard to get it precise. And I think Atu said it in his book too, is like, checklists cannot be this like universal checklist that you found on the internet. It's not going to be as useful. You need it to be uniquely customized to your context.
So that's kind of the second stumbling block that they came across. So you want checklists to be general enough that you can reuse them, because if every single thing gets its own checklist, you don't get any value from iterating and improving.
Right.
But you also need it to be specific enough. I think we hit a good balance with the year of experiments. You need it to be specific enough that you don't have a whole bunch of junk on there, that it's not set up for square peg and round hole. It needs to be something where you've got the level of specificity. Thank you. Specificity that you need to have it be valuable, to have it actually meet the needs of what you're trying to check. And the right level of generalized.
Right level generalized. And then I think one, they are so specific that you can only use for this one custom situation at a time and can never be reused. That means you are not retaining the knowledge and the added wisdom from every time you screw up, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The other part is the main problem with a lot of checklists is that if the people are not using it with good faith effort, right? Like they may be using it. So when they tried this WHO checklist in Canada, they came back and said, oh, this checklist didn't do anything. We didn't see any difference. And when they actually look into it, they found that the doctors were not actually doing the items from the checklist, like confirm the patient's name by saying out loud or mark the site of the operation. They weren't doing it, and they were just checking the boxes.
So every time they do the surgery, they just check.
They just check, check, check. And as they are not actually using the checklist with a good faith effort, they are just like, you're making me do it. I'll just check off a bunch of things. Compared to when they went to Scotland and they did the same thing and they found all the results that WHO was finding because they were actually using it with good faith effort. So I think that's same checklist, two different contexts, two different teams. One is totally bought in. One is I'll do it because you made me, right? So the one important thing is having the team or the person who is actually going to be operating be part of the creation of the checklist.
Yeah.
And have that engagement. I think it's like when you get your 9-year-old to be involved in their daily checklist, which we have at home.
Yeah.
Right? So both our kids have a daily checklist to get ready. And
that we're not using.
We're not using because it's summer and we fell off the wagon. But they
but the
were.
There.
The idea was there. They're the one who help us develop that checklist, right?
Yeah.
And I think if you engage the affected parties in creating the checklist, it feels a lot more like it's their thing. Yeah, it's their thing, right?
Sense of ownership. I think that's been a challenge a little bit for us because we are going into year 15 as a company. And a lot of these checklists have been around for 10, 15 years.
And they didn't know the origin. The other part right. of the origin is like each of the item checklists, you know, there's a joke that like, you know, you go to a restaurant and they see this super weird rule they put outside their bathroom door. And you're like, oh, somebody must have tried to do this
no
at some point.
No raccoons in the bathroom. Somebody brought a raccoon.
So,
or it's a joke.
All the checklists that we have in our checklist, they didn't know how that item got into that checklist. Like there's if they I feel like even GQs, right? We can make items in there, but we have to give like this historical context of, you know, 2019 May, Mo edited this because we spectacularly forgot to update the pricing grid for this feature, right? Like we don't have the examples and the context of why it's there.
Yeah, it's just, oh, I have to do this 60-item checklist.
Yeah, I think one thing that we've been doing a great job is updating it with every time after a product launch, after a thing is run, right? After we did an offsite, we do a retrospective or postmortem. And basically, hey, from the things that we learn, right? What are the good things? What are the bad things? And then if something unexpectedly good happens, we are like, hey, you know, so-and-so unexpectedly did this, and that made everything super easy. We go and put it into the checklist of, hey, next time, do this.
Yeah.
Same thing with like when we failed to do something or we forgot something.
Which
we
is
go
where
and,
most of the items in our checklist
yeah,
came
exactly.
from.
And that have shown the newer team members how these themes are evolving because they are part of the evolution and updating. But I think it's important for us to sometimes go and be like, we need to revamp and reconsider the entire checklist.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it will outlive the usefulness and like the list that got too big, right? Like once you get to 70, 90 items, it gets almost too tiresome.
One of the things that's changed is it used to be that having a video on your homepage was incredibly important for getting people to install your product after they go to your homepage. So we always, every feature had to have a video and it had to be a really good one. And now that's gone away. Like a simple animation seems to work better now. And so we don't need a you know, 8-week lead time and all these steps to make a great video, because we mostly don't need that quality of video on the homepage anymore. So that whole section, like at our last discussion where we got the team together to discuss what do we want to change about the checklist, well, this isn't really relevant anymore.
Right. So I think this evolution and contextually updating the checklist with the time is how you make sure even people who went there at the creation to be still bought in and feel the ownership.
And when you have that explicit, hey, we want feedback, we want to talk about this, that's also when they can get the context. They can say, oh, I don't think we need this. You say, oh, we need that because the press folks got it once and they said it was free and it's not free because we didn't put it in the pricing grid.
Right. The story time are usually.
But that's valuable. Like the story time getting passed along to everybody is like, you know, that gives them the context. They learn from our mistakes instead of having to make them all themselves. And that's the value of the checklist.
But does it scale? That's the other part, right? I feel like the value of checklist is it creates the standard operating procedure, or like the standard that a team can scale, right? If you are a consulting firm and you have a new client onboarding checklist, then it doesn't matter who your account manager is onboarding this new client. They get the same consistent experience. And I think as someone who have hired plenty of different consultants, and you can tell which firms have a good checklist.
Oh, like vendors. Yeah.
Vendors.
Yeah, you
can. Consultants and vendors. And we are the clients and we can tell whether the consulting firm has a good, consistent onboarding checklist.
Sets the tone for the whole relationship.
It does. So you were talking about that paper.
Yeah. The main things are you want to make sure that... So checklists are a very general purpose tool. They're really lightweight. They're really simple, but they're really powerful. And they help reduce errors and they help free up your mind for thinking about more strategic, more thoughtful aspects of a task. To make a checklist work well, you want the items on it to be deterministic and decidable. You want the checklist to be generalized at the right level so that it's specific enough that it's relevant to what you're working on, but also broad enough that you can learn from reuse. And you want to engage with the team to make sure that they have a voice in creating the checklist and get buy-in and also make the checklist better.
Also, like, engaging the team would make sure that the language and the words that you are using make sense to them. Right?
Absolutely.
Because they are the one coming up with it.
Absolutely. And that way you make sure that the right things are on there too.
Right.
Do you want to wrap up with a tip of the week?
I think my suggestions would be identify at least one area of your team or your daily workflow or what you do that comes up more than once and see if it's something that you can use a checklist and implement it.
Sounds great.
And I would love to hear all the listeners who are using checklists in their team and work context. What do you use it for? How do you use it?
What's your favorite checklist?
And what's your favorite checklist? I'm going to wrap up this episode with a funny checklist story. So the band Van Halen is known for their very weird pre-concert instruction. In the contract that they gave you to go to a venue, they said, we want a bowl of M&Ms, but all the brown M&Ms must be removed.
That brown is a very controversial color.
And so people thought they're just being eccentric rock stars.
Yeah.
But what they are doing is apparently they were one of the most technical setups that they need for their band.
Oh, their stages were crazy for the time.
Exactly. So they know that if the venue manager doesn't read the contract enough to notice the brown M&M, which is kind of weird and, you know, should stand out.
Yeah.
If they didn't notice it, and if they go to the dressing room and see the brown M&Ms in the bowl, they know that these people didn't actually follow the checklist for the setup for their band.
So they better double check everything.
So
maybe
then,
triple check it.
Then they run the whole checklist for safety because all these crazy setup for their stage could actually hurt people, the band members, and the audience.
Yeah.
So that was their trick checklist minefield. basically.
Yeah, you know whether or not somebody's paying attention.
Yeah, so that's my funny checklist story.
On that note, we might as well jump to the next episode.
Hey, are we willing to share templates?
Yeah, absolutely.
It'll be great if people can share us with their, what's your favorite checklist, the checklist that you guys use that you really love. And we can also share our experiment checklist.
Yeah, as usual, we'll have links to the papers and books some and templates. Things we talked about, but we'll also share some of our internal templates from Boomerang.
Yeah.
Just in case you need a starting point.
All right.
Happy checklisting.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Less Busy Lab. If you haven't already, please.
Can I say it? I want to say it.
Okay, fine.
Smash that subscribe button!
Are you happy now?
So happy.
Please subscribe to our podcast to get all our future episodes. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Find me on LinkedIn for more behind-the-scenes content and updates.
We'll put the links to all the research papers, tools, and templates mentioned in the episode in the show notes.
We'll also be adding a listener questions segment in the future episodes. So if you have any productivity-related questions, send us an email at questions@lessbusylab.com.
Our sponsors this week are the same as they are every week, GQs and Boomerang. Check them out.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you're already feeling less busy and more productive.